Behold the sword of power, Excalibur. Forged when the world was young, and bird and beast and flower were one with man, and death was but a dream.
Greetings and well met, travelers. You have found your way to Dragonreel, a magical journey to the realm of fantasy movies.
Welcome back to Dragonreel, the Fantasy Film Lovers Podcast. This is episode 14. We're going to talk about the 1981 John Boorman film, Excalibur. I'm Chris. I'll be your host, even though I was not born to live a man's life, but to be the stuff of future memory. In chair number two, no queen of yours can ever match her. It's Sharon.
And can I just say, if Arthur was my husband, I would have not gone for Lancelot. I would have stayed faithful.
Being as Chris is your husband, you did go for Lancelot. Is that what you're saying?
Wait!
No, wait a minute. That's not what I said.
I'm just extrapolating. In chair number three, his lust will hold him up. A dream to some, a nightmare to others. It's Pete.
That's only because I am the dragon.
Yes.
You can sleep in my scales anytime. I just wanted to let you know that.
Well, I am the warrior, shooting at the walls of heartache. Bang, bang.
Bang, bang.
He is the dragon.
I am the dragon.
Hey, guys. Hey, before we get started, I wanted to ask the audience for a favor.
Knock it away.
Okay, audience, if you're a fantasy lover and you like this show, please go to iTunes and give us a review. It'll help our rankings on iTunes. It'll help other people find us. And if you have other fantasy friends, share the podcast with them. Not fantasy friends, like real friends who like fantasy. Anything you'd like to request or let us know about, email the show at dragonreelpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
I want you to know that Harvey is now sulking.
Okay, sorry. give him a carrot, Chris, send him off in a corner, it'll be great.
There you go.
And you'll make Chris and Pete and Sharon so happy. We'll all do the happy dance.
Hey, I had some advice for the audience as well.
Laid on us.
Okay, if you haven't gotten a chance to watch the movies we're going to talk about, go on over to dragonreel.com and click on the movie there. It'll take you to Amazon, and if you buy anything while you're there, it'll send a few pennies our way and help us with some of the cost of keeping the show on the air. And as you know, the best way to enjoy Dragonreel is to watch the movie first and then come and join us for the talk. So if you just ordered it and you're waiting for Excalibur to arrive, pause the show now and come back after you've seen it. We will wait here.
Unless they don't mind spoilers.
All right, welcome back.
Exactly.
Thanks for watching the show, and now we're going to talk about the movie we all just saw.
Ooh,
it's all fresh in our minds. It's going to be great.
Oh, pick me. Can I summarize it?
Yes, no queen of anyone's can match you. It's Sharon.
Oh. Wait. I can summarize. No, go ahead.
No, okay. Well, if I do a really sucky job, Pete, you can jump in, and I won't be upset.
Oh, I shout.
Okay. Excalibur, the movie about the land and the king being one. This movie is also about love, lust, and how... Okay, I lost it. Love, lust, and how that lust...
Hey, phrasing!
Betrays the land and the king. The end.
Well, okay, I'll go along with that.
That wasn't bad, but I...
It wasn't
bad, there's,
but you could
there's,
do it better. Okay,
there's some more to it. No. I'm happy to go off of that just for time's sake.
I said short summary.
Yes, well, you did.
Well, the summary of this movie is it's basically retelling the legend of King Arthur, Knights of the Round Table, and his quest for the Holy Grail.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. That was good, too.
Yes.
I like the love and lust part, though.
I like the love and lust part, too, but there's also a certain desire for empower. I think there's a certain ambition that goes into that as well that brings about the downfall. But we can talk about that later.
Or actually, we can talk about it now. So we did the whole summary, and like the first, 20 minutes of the movie is not even what the movie's about. It's like how we get into the movie.
You mean the whole thing with Uther and okay?
Oh,
gotcha.
No. See, I would disagree with that. I think the beginning is very important because it's showing you the character of Uther, and that Uther could
he's a colossal idiot?
Right, that he could not be. He couldn't be the king because he let his lust and his own motivations outweigh the good of the land.
But again, that's where the ambition comes in. He is a man of vaulting passions and ambition.
Okay, yeah. let's talk about Uther then for a little bit. Here's Uther's entire, you know, this is what he wants out of everybody. This is why he fights.
Speak the words.
One land, one king! That is my peace, Cornwall!
So he's all of England is in war, is at war, and all Uther wants is to be king over everybody. Is that so much to ask?
Yeah, that's not all he wants.
But you have to realize that even in the case of Uther, he's not asking to be king of all over England. He's asking to be king of the south of England.
Okay.
Midlands in the north are still in disarray and still considered barbaric.
Mm-hmm.
He wants you know, Wales, Cornwall, and kind of the Midland, you know, lower Midlands and south areas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but then, of course, the problem comes in when he sees Igraine.
Well, you know what? It's frickin' Cornwall's fault. Because he's like,
wait,
yeah, guess what I've got? You know, he's got, like, you know, check this out.
My wife will dance for us! Igraine, dance!
Dance, show monkey!
John Borman called out for using his own daughter in that scene. But
yeah, I am totally calling John Borman a complete perv for using his daughter in this whole movie.
I agree.
Just because of everything that Igraine is. Basically, Igraine is the sex object of the show.
Well, okay, so
you have to realize that
she is kind of sexy, though. I mean,
there are repeating symbols and themes throughout this movie. One of the repeating symbols is that there are things that are wanted. Okay? Things that people will go out of their way for. So Igraine is that at the beginning. You know, Excalibur is that before Arthur pulls it from the stone.
Mm-hmm.
Unification is that once Arthur pulls the sword from the stone. You know, and then the Grail is the ultimate.
So every single dramatic moment in this story is propelled by somebody who promises more than they're willing to sacrifice.
Yes.
Somebody who says, I don't care what the cost is, I want it now. I'll worry about the cost later.
Many times, yes.
You will swear by your true kingship to grant me what I wish. Then you shall have it.
By Excalibur, I swear it.
What issues from your lust shall be mine. Swear it again.
I swear it!
Because he's...
And let I say... Isn't it adorable looking at young Gabriel Byrne and Liam Neeson and just a whole bunch of guys who we know now, but back then they were, you know, fresh-faced, young, mid-20s, fresh out of RADA.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So Uther is like, yeah, I swear it, because he's like, he's talking out his boner, quite frankly.
I think that Merlin knew that there was going to be a child. I mean, like, 100%.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what he's just asking for.
But that's not just that. It's the fact that Merlin admits to being the manipulator here. He admits to the guy who has been trying to unify England. And if Uther can't do it, and obviously Uther is not the man he thought he was going to be because of this agreement, that's why he has Uther agree to give up his firstborn to him.
Yes. But he doesn't say, you know, you're going to have a child and you need to.
He kind of does just now.
No, he says whatever comes of this, you know, he doesn't say it's going to be a child, but he knows it's going to be a child.
What else would it be?
Yeah, how else? I mean, I can't think of how else to interpret that question. So what that leads to is the creepiest thing in this whole movie, which is John Borman directing his naked daughter to writhe and grind like she's having the best F
sex
of her life.
Yes.
With a guy in armor, while his other daughter sits in the back of the scene and watches.
Yep.
Well, can I just say, I never knew that. And when I watched it, I thought it was a really, I guess the only word I could use there is hot scene. Because I didn't know that.
But it's also incredibly creepy.
Well,
it's really creepy.
But maybe he's just an artist. Maybe the guy is just very...
John Borman is very much into his films, I will tell you that much.
Yeah.
The point that I was trying to make was that when Uther actually holds his son, he's willing to give it all up.
Yes.
He's willing to put down sword, undo the armor, and rule as a peaceful being. The problem is that by then it's too late. you know?
Because he betrayed the Duke.
Here, I've got that one. I know you want to hear it. So here's the thing about audio capture. If I captured all the best lines, you would only hear Merlin.
It's true.
Merlin has the best lines. It's true.
You betrayed the Duke. You stole his wife. You took his castle. Now no one trusts you.
No one trusts you.
No one trusts you. And neither do I. Silly king.
So that's about 20 minutes in. And,
I think that's one of the best lines in the movie.
This is well before Arthur even takes the stone, the sword out.
One of my favorite moments, though, is when young Morgan, or Morgana in this one, walks up and goes, "Are you the child's father and mother now, Merlin?"
And the child's father and mother, Merlin.
Oh, yes. Yeah, with that horribly dubbed voice. Actually, all of the voices in here are really badly dubbed. The sound engineer in this movie should be taken out back and flogged.
It's not that it's bad ADR.
It was in 81, though. You have to think what movies were like in 81.
Well, plus, yes.
Well, I mean, look at Flash Gordon. There's sound work in that one. We know early on that Morgan has the sight, which means that she has a touch of whatever it is that makes them sorceress.
Right. She saw through the disguise.
Right.
A magical disguise.
Yes.
Which, by the way, was the dumbest thing Merlin could possibly have done.
Why do you think that, Chris?
Uther says, "I must have that woman. Nothing will satisfy me until I have that woman." Merlin should have said, "Okay, then sit right here. I will use all of my powers of sorcery and disguise and illusion to make this tavern wench look like a grain. Go nuts."
I don't think that would have worked.
Plus, you also have to, again, you forget where Merlin is coming from at this point in time.
Yeah, he's got the long game there.
He's got the long game, but he also thinks that he thinks up to that point that Uther might be the one, and then Uther shows that he's not.
Yeah.
And so he's got to do something, and I feel, I mean, it's never obvious in the movie, but I feel from the subtext is that Merlin feels that the Pendragon line, which is kind of like a ho-ho behind the hand sort of joke, because in old Welsh, a Pendragon is the war chief.
Okay.
A given group. Therefore, the commander-in-chief and nominally the king. That the Pendragon line is what will ultimately unite England.
Mm-hmm.
Or Britain.
It's where it's at.
Who are the Britons? We're all Britons.
So he's basically trying to create the Kwisatz Haderach.
No. He is trying to create a situation in which everyone will unite by playing upon their superstitions. And that's why he uses one of Voylin's swords. He uses Excalibur as the unifying symbol. Excalibur is one of the swords of Voylin.
So I did not know that, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I can't stand Arthurian legend.
I studied it really, really for when I was doing lit my second.
When I was a kid and I was getting into D&D, I started reading it and. It was like I read like three different versions.
Okay.
And I really didn't like any of them. And I figured out why later on. And it's because.
It's steeped in Christianity.
No! It's because the story of Arthur is essentially a story of decay.
Right. And that's the whole point. It's the story of hope and then the story of decay. It's kind of like Christ. You never have the middle part of his reign,
mm-hmm.
You only have the beginning and the end.
But the story of Arthur is a happy beginning. It's like, you know, one-tenth of the way in. That would be the happy ending of any other story.
Yeah, but that's not the point. The point of the matter is that Arthur is, from a storytelling standpoint, the way to convert people over to a Christian mindset.
By telling them that everything falls apart? That you have one shining golden moment and then everything dies?
No, you see, you're missing the point. That there is a point wherein that even though there will be a golden age, but all golden ages have an end, but there is always the promise of return.
Yes.
Okay? Arthur promises to return.
I just want to start singing. Like, in short, there's simply not a more congenial spot for a happy ever aftering than here in Camelot. Anyway, I don't know if I mean, I respect you very much, dear heart, but I...
But you're so wrong!
I disagree with you. I think that Excalibur is more about knightly qualities and honesty and honor and how the land thrives under this, you know, very good and almost, you know, holy king. And then what happens is he's betrayed. And he's betrayed because, well, because reasons. And
it's not just because reasons. It shows again and again when people give in to sinful acts, tragic things happen.
Yeah,
when people give in to noble acts, excellent things happen.
Right.
So and you've got when Gawain finally removes his fear.
Right.
And is willing to sacrifice himself, then he gets the Grail.
Yeah,
when Arthur doesn't even think anything of himself, but decides instead he wants to get this for his brother,
yes.
he whips out Excalibur, you know, from
yes.
the stone.
And it was a totally giving gesture because he didn't want to be king.
No, he said here's Excalibur, and
he hands it to his brother. Huh. Yes,
you know, but every time that somebody gives into something, something bad happens.
Yes,
Uther gives into his lust. Guinevere and Lancelot give into their lust.
Right.
Morgan gets into her desire for power.
For power, mm-hmm. yes.
You know, stuff like that. And as a result, horrible things happen. But once you start to line up with the seven virtues, everything is good again.
Yes.
And it takes Christ's cup to bring that back to the land. Mm-hmm. Which, as one of the cool things about Excalibur is that it's got symbolism for both Christianity and paganism.
Yes. And I think that's maybe why I like it, because there's all this stuff with, and, you know, what is this root? Oh, it's Mandrake, and it will do this. And I really like that, and I really like how Merlin is part of the court, even though he says he's fading. I love it when Guinevere...
Time is through, you know, when he tells
yeah.
Morgan, time is through.
Yeah. But the part I like the most is when Arthur and Guinevere are dancing, mm-hmm. and Arthur comes over and says, you know, who will I marry? You know, like who will it be? And there's this whole thing about, you know, looking into the cake is like looking into the future. You'll never know. And I just love that. I love
never
how, like,
you take a bite, and then by that, of course, it's too late.
Yes.
Too late.
And the mix,
there,
the
I got
mix
it right
of,
here.
You know,
looking at the cake,
this was for you.
Looking at the future. Until you've tasted it, what do you really know?
And then, of course, it's too late.
Wait for it.
Too late.
I love that mix of paganism and Christianity kind of coming together, where it seems sometimes, you know, when Arthur goes to, he knows that Merlin knows these things and can tell
right.
him. And he's not content to just let it be. He wants to know, you know.
The other really cool thing about their relationship is that it is definitely not a father-son relationship.
Mm-hmm. No.
It is definitely a mentor to friend relationship.
I was just going to say a mentor to friend. I think Arthur
that's
is his
phenomenal.
Friend.
And it's not just that. It's the fact that Arthur embraces both situations, you know? And the thing is that the concept of the Grail, the symbol of the Grail, isn't just Christ's cup. It's also the fact that that kind of thing, the cauldron, the Grail, the cup, has always been a symbol amongst the pagans in the islands.
Yes.
You know, it's the cup usually of the Dagda Nuer or of Mat Matanwy or Trumcruach or somebody who are the earth deities. They're the ones who create stuff from the land.
Yes. Another point that I would like to make, and I've read a lot of these books too, and I've read Myths of Avalon and all these really cool books that kind of show how the pagans are trying to help, but yet they sort of keep going down these paths that it's hopeless. But anyhow, it's interesting to me that there's a part in the movie when Merlin is shocked. I think there are actually a couple times when he's like, wait a minute.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see that.
What is he doing? I didn't see this coming. I think it's when Arthur
breaks Excalibur.
No, not then. I mean, that's
another
one. Oh,
when he asks, what's his name to knight him?
The knight, I think, is it Jean-Luc?
No.
No, it's Bondera?
it's a server.
Yeah,
and he says, you're right, I'm not a knight, I'm just a page. He said, then you shall knight me. And he gives him the sword, and Merlin's like freaking out. Like, you can tell by the actor's face, because I remember seeing this movie when I was sighted, and I even heard it. He's like, wait a
what's
minute,
this?
What's this?
I didn't
and
see that.
It's really incredible, because even Arthur really, I guess it's just the way things happen in life, almost fortune or fate, or like fate can be changed depending on your actions. And
I
Arthur's
that was
so
Boris,
pure.
Because Leon de Grance was Jean-Luc, so think it was Morris who knights him. But I think also, again, fantastic show of what happens when you don't give in.
Right.
When he looks at the sword and he decides not to lop off his head and knight him anyway.
Yeah.
And he kisses the tip of the sword and says, I'll follow you.
Yeah, and it was because he was overwhelmed by the truth of Arthur and the purity of Arthur.
And the virtue of the situation. He took advantage of the virtue of the situation. Good things came of it.
Yes. And that's why I love this story, because I love the thought of hope and that, you know, if you're good, that right, you know, what is that the saying, that right makes might?
Reverse it.
Oh, light makes right. But I believe in that. And kind of a crossover, when I'm playing D&D, I love to play those types of characters.
To be righteous, you're saying?
And the, you know, the righteous fury and, you know, like saving the good and you know, killing evil and saving the innocents and all of that. And that's why it's so heartbreaking when all of the knights kind of see this relationship between Lancelot and Guinevere, and nothing has really happened.
I'm not really sure how they see it because he's never around.
It's because of Morgan Le Fay.
Yes, she's whispering in their ears.
Yeah, she's poisoning them to Lancelot. That's the whole point. And that's the thing with when he says, "Have we vanquished evil? Good and evil. There never is one without the other."
Mm-hmm.
And as he says that, he looks right at Morgan.
And I think when Lancelot does come to court, it's that fiery attraction, which also happens because when Lancelot is hurt, mm-hmm. Arthur then asks, and this isn't in most of the legends, that Arthur asks for a pagan ritual to be performed where Lancelot needs a reason to live.
Right.
And Guinevere is there, and puts her hand on him, and it kind of cements that is his reason to come back and to live again.
Right.
And again, Arthur kind of did it out of a pure heart.
It's not just that. He takes the business of being king very seriously.
Yes.
He even tells her straight up, when it's time to defend her honor, you can't step up for me. I can't. I have to be your judge. I'm your king.
Yes. Oh, that moment.
And that's for husband?
Yes. And that moment is so incredibly moving. Because as a woman, I can feel what Guinevere would feel like. Like, you're betraying me. Like, you have to stick up for me. And
well, if I were king, Sharon, you would come before my kingdom.
But I don't know then if I would admire you as a king.
And that's it. I don't think that anybody would admire you as a king and the thing would fall apart. That's why it's important.
But it fell apart anyway.
Regardless of the fact that it fell apart anyway, the point is that it didn't fall apart because Arthur was the one who was weak.
Right. Arthur was a king, and he couldn't. He couldn't champion her because
it would not be right. He was the judge. He had to judge the contest, you know?
Yeah.
And when Lancelot shows up, and in spite of the fact that he's mortally wounded, beats the living snot out of poor Liam Neeson.
Yeah. There are moments that I remembered this movie from watching it like 20 years ago, because there are just shining moments. And then there are some really stupid moments,
I
admit.
The fact that it's just absolutely gorgeous. John Borman shot it in a place called Powers Court in Ireland. And it's one of the best parks you will ever go to. It is just absolutely stunning. There are all these tiny waterfalls. There are all these little dells. There's everything. And you get far enough away from the roads and take a deep breath, you can feel like, yes, this is a place where there would be an old sorcerer surrounded by animals, you know.
Wow. Or maybe Lancelot napping yet again in the movie.
Exactly. Or something like that.
How many times does Lancelot fall asleep in this movie?
Hey, man, that armor is heavy, okay? Pick up some slack. It's not like it's made out of paper.
So here's one thing I will give the movie. I am giving it a complete pass for historical accuracy on the armor.
Good.
Because it is a clear stylistic choice.
Yes.
That they're trying to show these people, you know. So I know a lot of people have seen this movie and gone, oh, somebody in the 900 AD would not have armor like that. It's like, yeah, okay. But this is, I'm pretty sure the director knew this.
Oh, I'm sure he did too. Some of the fighting techniques wouldn't have been used in the 900s.
Yeah.
Or even 700s, depending on which Arthur you're looking at.
Yeah,
you know?
And they also wouldn't be speaking modern English, so what's your point?
Oh, okay, whatever. You know, I still think it's a great fantasy movie. There's a shot when Merlin is coming up. He's way in the distance, and he's like sort of...
You see him walking in the background, and they're having a conversation.
Yes.
He goes, Arthur says, "Who's Merlin?" And he goes, "I am Merlin."
I am Merlin.
It's
and
such great.
That shot is so. I mean, being blind, I just want to say that that scene has in my memory, and I really think that that's definitely an award, a credit to a movie maker when a blind person says, "I can remember that scene." Out of all the things in the world that you could picture, like a baby's face, a rainbow, a sunset, I can remember that scene where Merlin is in the frame and walking up. Isn't that crazy?
Well, it's fantastic. It's a great – they timed it so well.
Yes.
Approaches. You know,
and you have to be paying attention to see it. You really have to be
– There are some very good directorial decisions in this movie.
Yes.
I know
there
you
are
hate
some
the sex
very,
scene, Chris.
It's not that I hate the sex scene. I don't really hate the sex scene. It just creeps me out a little. What I hate is the fighting.
Oh, the fighting.
The fighting scenes, like, I can't tell who anybody is. How can they? And it's not really clear what's going on while people in armor are hitting people in identical armor.
Well, I think that's true also to the past.
No, we've thrown historical accuracy away, though.
It is hard in a battle.
It is. That's why. Do you know the whole story behind like the leaks on the back of the Welsh pound?
Tell me.
Okay. So there was. This is partially attributed to Arthur, but another Welsh knight to determine because they had very similar armor to determine his men from others. He had them pull the leaks from the field and stick them in their helmets.
Hmm.
So he knew who was on his side. Okay, so that's how they would usually tell each other apart. Ideally,
so if you want to be my friend, you have to take a leak.
You have to take a leak.
God, guys.
In the field with a bunch of other guys.
It's a bonding experience.
This whole thing, you know, if you read a lot of war stuff, even in the Napoleonic times, you know, sometimes.
Sure. But, you know, I'm not complaining that, you know, that it's historically inaccurate. I'm complaining that, as a film, it's not telling me anything when I see a bunch of, you know, people doing nondescript things to nondescript people.
So you want one side in red and one side in blue.
That's not what I want. I want to know what's going on the screen.
Okay. Well, do you have a suggestion that would have made it better?
I can't think of a single fantasy movie where it was this indeterminate what was going on.
I kind of like that, though, in and of the fact that always seems like the chaos of early battles, especially...
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too.
But, well, I mean, if the only thing you want to say is people are fighting, then, you know...
I totally dig what you're saying. I mean, it would be nicer to find out that, oh, look, Arthur's side is winning.
Uh-huh.
You know, Modred's side is winning, kind of thing, you know, but with the most difficult part about that, of course, is the whole fight in the fog.
Yeah.
You know, you're fighting in the fog, of course nobody's going to know what's going on.
Oh, the whole last third of the movie's in fog.
Yes. Maybe? Yes.
Yeah, a lot of it. That's the main thing I remember about everything after Arthur says, we have to... You know what? I've got it right here. Everything Arthur says after this...
We must find what was lost. The Grail. Only the Grail can restore Leif. And flower.
You are so wrong. It is not completely in fog from that point on. It's in mud and muck and
yes.
Yeah, I mean
death and doom and where did all those knights hanging from the trees come from? Because there weren't that many people at the table.
But it's because it's exactly what Lancelot says. He says the sword is between them. They wake up, and I know I'm going to get the line wrong, but the gist of it is. A king without a sword, a land without a king. And
right.
He loses his shit. Because that's the point.
Arthur is a means of atonement on the sword.
Yes. Wow. Yeah.
Well, I agree. As far as like restoration plans go, Arthur saying we have to find the Grail is a plan that he pulls literally out of his ass. Like, he's sitting there in the chair, reaching behind him and going, here's a plan, we need the Grail! There is nothing in the movie that tells us why he thinks the Grail is a good idea.
Maybe that's... not in the movie.
No, in the movie. You have to know the story. And I agree. Okay, everybody knows this story. Everybody knows that the Knights of the Round Table go searching on a quest for the Holy Grail.
But why? You know, what motivated them to do that? What was it that gave him the insight into that? And that's kind of a big question, because the priest doesn't play as big of a role in the movie as he does in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Which is where Arthur gets the idea for the Grail.
Okay.
In the book.
But the problem that I had with that part was, mm-hmm. you're telling a story to people who must necessarily already know that part of the story.
Right.
Well, who else would be watching Excalibur?
Somebody who wanted to see a fantasy movie?
You know, that's funny. That was always the thing that cracked me up when Siskel and Ebert reviewed the original Batman by Tim Burton.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, the biggest problem that they always had was they always knew Bruce Wayne was Batman.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, yeah, no shit, Bruce Wayne is Batman.
Batman. I mean, that's
it. You wanted that to be the big reveal? Come on!
Superman? Jesus. You know, like,
have you seen the Jimmy Kimmel short about this, like, deleted scene from Batman v Superman?
Yes, where they're walking back and forth, and he goes, you're Superman.
You're Superman. Yes.
That part, going back a little bit.
Okay.
I disagree with you. I didn't think about it that much, Chris. I just thought, well, of course they have to get the Grail. Things are shitty. You've got to
get
the Grail.
Of course you need the Grail. It's King Arthur. He needs the Grail. But you know that because you know the King Arthur stories.
Right.
Yes. I don't know one person in America that, well, I guess I shouldn't say that.
All right.
But
well, let me reach out to our readers. If you live in America and you didn't know that King Arthur wanted to go after the Holy Grail, give us a call. Email us at dragonrealpodcast@gmail.com and tell us that you didn't know this story already.
That you've never read any of the Arthurian legends.
And that's okay.
Done an overview of the Arthurian legends.
Right.
Being a fantasy fan and all.
So, I am curious though, Chris.
You're curious? I'm curious.
Did you have any favorite parts of this movie? Because you said, you sort of told us what you did not like, but I would love to know what parts you enjoy.
I liked most of Merlin's lines.
I knew that was coming. I knew it! I could have made money on that! Shit! I was going to say, I like all the Merlin parts. It's a shame he disappears at the halfway point.
Right? And, you know, the person that the movie is actually about appears at the half-hour mark.
Wait, who do you think it's about?
It's about Arthur.
Oh, okay.
But it's not about Arthur. It's about Excalibur and the transitions.
The land and Arthur.
You know, it's not just about him. He might be the poster child, but it isn't solely about him.
Well, and it's about the relationship between Arthur, Lancelot, and Guinevere. Arthur loves both Guinevere and Lancelot.
Even that's not the primary, because you also have the relationships between Morgan and Merlin and Arthur. You know, Arthur.
Sure.
And, you know, you've got all sorts of
stuff. Okay, I guess, yes. So, but you know, when you think about it, and if you say to someone, Arthur, Lancelot, and Guinevere, you know, people are like, ah, oh, yes. And there's a moment.
Guinevere, I knew that bitch.
I love Guinevere's voice in this. I think her voice is very sexy.
Is she somebody that we should know who it is? I mean, there's a lot of people who are really huge.
The right actress.
Nigel Terry and I can't remember the she's got an unusual, almost Italian last name.
Let me IMDb it now.
But I love the part, Chris. I think you have a clip of this when Guinevere approaches Arthur. Not Arthur, sorry, Lancelot, on the road. And she says, well...
Oh, yeah, I got it right here.
But surely, there must be some lady somewhere in the world who inspires you.
There is one.
Who is she? Oh, go on, tell me. Oh, go on.
You?
Oh, you're teasing me.
I will love you always. I will love you as my queen and as the wife of my best friend. And while you live, I will love no other.
Oh, freaking Lancelot, what is it with you French knights? Good God!
But and that...
Sherry Lungi is who played Guinevere.
She's amazing. Yes. I love her voice. And also, I've read a lot of books about that whole there's a name for it. When a man loves a woman and...
Okay, thank you, Percy.
It's called something, and it was about this knightly love, and it started...
Unrequited love?
Where if you really loved a woman, like, you could lie in bed with her but and not do anything, but to show her how much you loved her.
I'm pretty sure that's called the friend zone.
I think what you're talking about, you have told me before, was called courtly love.
Courtly love, yes. And
which is
I
that
just...
Courtney love.
But from that moment, you know that she's thinking about what he said. Because what kind of woman wouldn't think about that?
The thing that I'd like to point out is the way that Guinevere reacts, the way when she first sees each one of them. The first time that she sees Arthur, she cocks her head to the side, as if at one side of her is like, that's really kind of funny, the way that this guy's wading into all these armored knights with just, you know, a leather jerkin on.
Yes.
And on the other side, that's kind of sexy, you know?
Yes. Yes.
But when she sees Lancelot the first time, she catches her breath.
Yeah.
Hmm.
She's taken aback.
She is taken aback, yeah.
She goes, what I'm saying is that while she loves Arthur with her heart, she loves Lancelot with her loins.
Oh, her loins.
Yes.
Mm.
I think it's like lightning. It's a spark.
In her loins.
No, it's not just her loins.
Although her loins have a lot to do with it.
It's a moment of recognition that is also mixed with fate and darkness and light and all of those things at one time, because it's bound to happen. Because everything leads up to the point where she puts his hand on his chest after he's wounded.
Merlin puts her hand on...
Well, that's what I meant. Yes.
But pronoun trouble.
But with Arthur's consent.
Because once again, he's willing to pay whatever he doesn't know he has to pay until after he has to pay it.
Yeah, again, that
it's,
is...
It's not, but it's not so much because he also has the implicit trust in Merlin, you know? I mean, that's the thing. Merlin is his mentor and his friend.
Right.
And they even have a couple of talks before and after these things, you know,
yes.
which are very good moments.
What is it that
Arthur asks is, what is the best...
Oh, the quality of knighthood, and asks Merlin?
And he asks Merlin.
You know, I don't actually have that quote. I've forgotten what the answer was.
Merlin says truth.
He tries to hedge, and he tries to say, like, all these things.
Well, it's got this thing. No, enough of your riddling. You know, what is the...
Yeah.
Very well, truth. That's it.
That's it. But you know what? I believe, Chris, that Arthur, he does accept. He knows what he's promising. I believe he does know from that.
I think also it kills him a little bit inside.
Because
he knows the cost?
Not that. It's because he loves his friend probably as much
so
as he
much.
Loves his
kid. I agree. But I'll play it and you can tell me from the tone of his voice you can derive that information.
Okay.
Save him, Merlin.
He has no will to live.
Bring him back, Merlin. Whatever the cost. Whatever the cost, do it. So be it.
But yet, and Merlin knows. Too.
I think he does
Merlin
know.
Merlin
knows.
And Arthur knows. Everybody knows. And yet, Guinevere tries, I think, in her own way, she tries to fight against it. But she can't. You know, she can't fight the love that she feels for Lancelot. And I think she almost accepts it because...
feeling any longer, and yet she's still afraid to let it flow.
Yes.
So you think it's time to let that ship into the shore?
Oh my god.
Throw away the oars forever?
But it's because, too, in her mind, Arthur failed her. He didn't, in her mind, the
I
moment
think that it's
he,
been alone.
Guinevere believes when Arthur doesn't champion her, she died a little bit. At that moment,
I think that she's hurt.
She is
hurt. But I don't see this as an action against him hurting her. I think it's that her desire for Lancelot is so great, it overwhelms everything else. I don't think it's because, you know, she feels that Arthur loves her any less per se. It's just tough for him to be the king. And you know, several talks about that. And the big one is when she's in the convent at the end and she's held on to Excalibur the whole time.
She has. And she's sorry. She's definitely sorry for what she did. Because that night of passion, you know, I don't think it wasn't all, I don't know. I mean, was it? We didn't really see the whole, we didn't see it. We saw it in a clip, right? We saw it. We saw them together. We saw Morgana looking at them.
Right.
Through like a cave type of window.
No, no. What happens is they get together.
Yeah.
Then it's got Merlin and Arthur on the parapets.
Yeah.
And then Arthur rides out of Camelot and Merlin takes Morgana into the cave.
Yes.
In order to trap her. And then he shows her that the cave has can make her stronger. And you see... Yeah. You see them together, and you see Arthur finding them and sneaking up with them in all that armor.
Yeah.
And some must have been some good 3 or 4 rounds on that one if they were tired enough to sleep through a guy in armor sneaking up on them, but still.
Right. Yeah, because we know the armor check penalty for stealth is really high.
It's really, especially in full plate.
I think Arthur, he said, are they together? Are they together, Merlin? And he's like, yes.
And so that Irish accent that comes and goes.
He did know it, and... And I think that Arthur thought he could withstand it. He could withstand the pain of it, and then he couldn't. And then he didn't. He didn't shove the sword into Guinevere or Lancelot. He shoved it between them.
And he, if you know what I mean.
He basically said, "You know, my life is over."
Hey,
no.
Phrasing.
No, whoa. I didn't say anything bad. I just said he felt like
but,
his.
But I think in the end, I think Arthur sums up the relationship between him and Guinevere with when he does the thing about what I owe no more, and I can just be a man, then
yes.
You and I will meet, and
oh,
I will be your husband, and you will come to me, and I will be your husband. It is a dream I have.
Oh.
You know, it's things like that. It's, you know, because he's never...
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain level of love that was never lost between them. It's just that because of pride and... society and all these other things that drove them apart.
Yeah, you know, we haven't talked at all about Arthur sleeping with his sister. We haven't said one thing about it.
It seems about par for the course for this film.
No, I think... I mean, and then his evil son.
Mordred,
yeah.
Mordred.
Yeah. I mean, he's like... Which I don't really get... Because he's part of Arthur, so...
No, he's part of a deceit.
Yeah, it was deceit. It was trickery, because she made herself look like Guinevere.
Right.
So, again, she used the magic.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you see the cost of the spell of making on a body.
Yeah.
You know, that's why Merlin always takes naps between, you know, summoning the dragon.
He needs to rest.
Yeah, because look at what happened to her. She aged like 70 years.
Yeah.
In the course of a couple of years.
Well, and because Merlin was in her dreams and kind of making her
That was the whole point of
power.
The dream to summon Nightmare to others.
Yeah, I love that part.
You brought me back. You loved me back.
Yeah, and also, Mordred kills his mother.
Yes.
Because it's interesting, too, that how, like, sometimes beautiful things are evil, and then how really the same thing is true that ugly things are also evil.
So everything's evil.
Well,
so it's a lot of evil.
The banister's evil.
It's not that it's a whole lot of evil. It's showing, it's very Freudian, first off, but second off, it's showing that Mordred is so absent of human kindness and compassion that he will not tolerate imperfection in anything, including his mother.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and even the scene where she's like, what is she's kind of caressing him in the armor? Like, yeah, that's your mother, dude. Like, it's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
You know the scene I'm talking about. And she says, you know, like, no arrow can pierce you, no weapon can
no
harm
weapon
you.
Ha ha ha, whoops.
Yeah. Boy, this talking about this is really making me want to watch Camelot.
Because the musical?
Yes, the musical, yeah. No, stop laughing at me.
I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing at that silly thing you said.
No, you're laughing at me. But I don't know. I think that the...
I am civilized. Sorry.
The feeling of hope is much more in Camelot. So, hey, guys, if you want to go out and also if you want to rent or buy Camelot, you should link that one. On the website, Chris. You should put Camelot.
Because we know that musicals are essentially fantastical. Nobody breaks into song and dance anymore.
No, come on. There's some great songs in there. if ever I would leave you, it would be in summer.
I'm not arguing that. Summer. I'm just saying.
No, I get you. It's not something that really happens in real life, so it must be fantasy.
Yes, precisely.
Yeah. I want to talk about the other movies this director has done.
I disagree.
Specifically, Deliverance and Zardoz.
No.
I haven't seen either one. So.
I refuse to talk about Zardoz, so there you go.
Okay. Zardoz is a science fiction retelling of The Wizard of Oz.
Well, I have
with Sean Connery in a diaper.
Wow. Okay.
It's not a diaper. It's just a very, very elaborate loincloth that actually wraps around his shoulders.
Yeah. And the penis is evil.
The penis is evil, and there's a giant head that chases everybody.
Yeah. So this director, John Boorman, looked at the finished cut of that movie and went, yeah, that's good, I'll release that.
Now, to be fair, John Boorman he funded that whole thing himself.
Uh-huh.
Nobody was going to give him any money for it, which you can't blame them. I wouldn't have given him money for it either, because it's just a huge steaming turd. But, you know, he believed in it enough that he was willing to put his own money behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which says something about, you know, speaks to the, I'm not going to call him an auteur per se, but speaks something to the director.
He had a vision. It wasn't a very good vision.
No, I agree. But the other problem is that he was hindered by the special effects at the time. He couldn't bring his vision fully to life. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't have what we have 40 years later.
Well, right. That was barely after Star Trek.
Not seeing it, I can't even rebut this because I haven't seen it yet. So.
But okay, so now let's talk about other things that came, other fantasy movies, iconic fantasy movies that came out the same time as this one. I don't even know if they did as well as this one. Well, I know one of them did.
Okay.
But this movie did very well.
Okay.
This movie had an $11 million budget and made about $35 million.
Okay.
It's gorgeous. The music in this is
fabulous. Oh, God, the music.
The music in this will not... It's just brilliant. I mean, even if you're not into the movie, that keeps you going.
The choice of music that already existed before this film was interesting. The funniest thing in this movie, the most unintentionally funny thing, came with the Orff piece, the Carl Orff. Yes, that part. What was really funny is like they showed the, you know, the Arthur's army getting ready to march, and they're playing the music, and then they cut to the other army and the music sounds like it's coming from far away.
Yes.
like the other army is bringing the music with them.
Yes, exactly. Like, I always thought that was great. I thought that was wonderful.
Somebody singing Latin? Where is that? Where is that coming from?
Can you hear that? Because the whole point is that they're listening to the music so they can't hear the horses.
Yeah.
That makes sense now.
See? You bring your own soundtrack so you hear your horses.
So, yeah, bringing your own soundtrack was something we should have learned from Fury Road.
No, no, no. We can call him what he is. He's a bard.
Yeah, he is.
He's inspired the masses on to greater you know, effort. So.
Yeah, so the music was good, but other films that came out at this time, Raiders of the Lost Ark did very well. That was also 1981. Time Bandits, Dragon Slayer, and Clash of the Titans. We've talked about Dragon Slayer.
Yes, we haven't talked about Time Bandits, which is a Terry Gilliam.
Right.
Joint.
And that's more of a... Yeah. I don't even know if I'd call that fantasy. No, that's
will
fantasy.
Will you guys do that straight one? I'm taking a leave of absence. I'm going to be sick that day.
For Time Bandits?
I hate that one. I can't sit through it.
I kind of get the feeling that you feel about Time Bandits the way I feel about Excalibur.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that you feel... I'm sorry to hear that you're so down on Excalibur, Chris. I really am, because I really think it's a rather wonderful movie, and the way that John Boorman utilizes an amazing amount of motifs and symbolisms in it is just fantastic.
Unbelievable.
I understand there's some filmmaker stuff going on, but I think it doesn't come together the way he wanted it to.
I think it comes together to complete the story, if anything.
I think the whole last 45 minutes of the movie was really hard for me to get through. It was just kind of down and tedious and really not really... uncomprehensible most of the time.
Was it the sad part? Should we have gone for the grandmas and kitties at that point in time?
All right. I think it's time to rate this movie. I do.
Oh, rate. Yes.
Yes. I do.
Easy. We talked about that scene already. We opened with
it. Yeah, we did.
Yep.
So I talked about the ickiness of it. Yeah, so anyway. So, Sharon, on a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces... How do you rate Excalibur?
Cha-ching.
I have to say that I rate Excalibur. If you would have asked me this question in college, I would have given it 5. And now I will give it 4 gold pieces.
Okay. Pete.
I rate it a hard 4.
Hard 4. Okay. Yes. Wow.
It is not perfect, but there's just so much
so
wonderful
many good
that goes
things.
On in it that I can't help but still love it even 35 years later.
Yes. Pete, you have me from It's Not Perfect.
So.
Well, heart of my heart, what do you want to rate the movie? And just remember, you have to sleep with me tonight. No, okay, I'm not going to hold that over your head. No, whatever you feel is what you feel.
If you're gonna, anyway.
But so, you left out the Courtney Love joke, and therefore you whatever you give it,
I
don't care.
I will give Excalibur 2 gold, but I want 1 silver back.
Why is that?
What?
2 gold? Just because of that whole tedious ending part that just kind of was way more stylistic than anything else that came before it, but it kind of went off the rails at the end.
Okay, fair enough. Wow.
Well, you know, he has his opinion.
I have my opinion.
And it's not worth shit, but still.
And if I agreed with you, we'd both be wrong.
Sorry. No, he has his opinion, and it's worth what ours are easily.
Did everyone go away? So the next time you come to Maryland, you and I are going to sit and watch Excalibur.
Okay.
Because...
No, wait, there's something... A little too thematic about that. I'm not quite sure where. You and I sitting together watching Excalibur. Chris,
are they together?
Yes.
Yeah, you can
cite. Are they together?
You can describe it to me too, Pete. Because
there you go.
Chris gave it 2 gold pieces. I don't even understand 2 gold pieces for Excalibur. I, you know, we have to talk more when we're off the air about this. I don't. I mean, not in a bad way, but I don't understand. I think he gave, you know, the one with the really bad dragons. I think he gave that one a 3.
Which one was the bad dragons?
Rain of Fire.
Rain of Fire. I think Rain I gave that a 3, yeah.
I think you gave that higher than
rated Rain of Fire higher than Excalibur. Go figure.
Yeah, I can't believe that. I really
I can, because I know Chris, but...
Right.
I mean, well, for one thing, it was a lot shorter.
Oh, Jesus.
Not to me.
You went there? It was shorter? That's the critique?
Wow.
That's great. Warner Brothers Looney Tune is shorter, Chris.
I mean, some of those lines from Excalibur,
it had some very good lines, and they didn't actually tell Arthur to keep his vertical up. I'll give you that.
There you go.
Wow.
His comic book bags are made of silk. Celebrities pay him for autographs. People want to hear him describe his RPG character. He is the most interesting fan in the world. I do not always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I listen to Slice of Sci-Fi. Stay geeky, my friends.
So, what's our next movie?
I think that for the sake of fantasy, we should watch Call the Conqueror.
I am on board with that.
Fantastic.
And I've never seen it before. So
Neither have I, so that's why I'm on board with it.
I have seen it.
I'm a virgin to that movie.
I have seen it, and I'm going to get the reputation for being the guy who picks all the B-movies, I can tell.
Actually, I've got a whole list of them. I've got, like, these Roger Corman collections that really need to be examined.
Okay.
But you'll say, so Call the Conqueror, you're going to launch us into the 90s.
I am. I'm launching us into the 90s.
Any movies from the 90s yet.
Yay.
And so, this is right smack in the middle of them.
Do you predict...
Oh, no, it's 97. Never
do
mind.
You predict, Pete, that I'm going to like it?
It's got Kevin Sorbo.
I'm going to love it. I talked to Kevin Sorbo. I love him. Yeah, in person, he's so sweet.
It's amazing. But, so this is a fantasy movie that does not take itself seriously. It is not the prequel to Conan that I anticipated it being, but it is still a lot of fun.
Okay.
Oh, fantastic.
I'm down with that.
All right.
Yes.
All right, so until next time, you can get a hold of us, or you can follow us on Twitter, at DragonReel. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/DragonReel. And you can email us via Gmail, and that is DragonReelPodcast@gmail.com. And you can also go to our website, DragonReel.com. Ooh-hoo. And if you want to send us a suggestion, we have a page specifically to suggest a movie to us.
Yes, and please let us know how we're doing, because we'd love to know that.
Yeah, we really want to hear some feedback. You can also find us on Stitcher, and there's a couple other places I'm trying to put the podcast out. I'm not even sure where they all go. There's so many ways to get a podcast out that I, you know, we'd really like to hear some feedback if, you know, what people want to hear more of, what people want to hear less of, and, you know, if you like us, if you hate us, if you say that, hey, this show's really awesome, but you got to get rid of that Chris fellow. It's too bad that I'm the one recording this.
Doesn't mean we can't get rid of you.
That's true.
Put that out there.
All right.
Have a great time and keep watching those fantasy movies.
And until next time, keep your vertical up.